Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. The following program has been brought to you by Cain Vineyard and Winery. Cain Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cain5.com.
Welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with two distinctly different but converging chefs, Pishe Ong and Julian Medina. Thanks for being here today.
Hello.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Oh, welcome. Sheltered from the rain. It's kind of nice. What's fascinating is that I've seen the trajectory of both of your careers for a long time. I even remember Julian when you were at Zocalo and Pishe when you were over at Spice Market. And now it's at a point where you two are working together. Even though you've worked in so many different restaurants around the world, different cuisines, there's a common ground at Coppelia. Can you tell me a little bit about the project?
Well, I think we met when Pishe was over at a Spice Market. We came over for dinner with my wife, and since then we know each other. We never worked together, but this is our first, you know, venture together. Yeah. I thought, Pishe and his super talent of being creative with desserts is just amazing. So, you know, we kind of got together for this this new concept that is just basically a Cuban kind of Latin diner that is open 24 hours and having fun desserts.
Yeah. And I mean, Pishe, do you have any Cuban background in cuisine and or ethnicity?
No, actually, I don't have any Cuban background. Yeah. I've never actually even been to Cuba, but I will at some point.
Well, I mean, I was asking you before, how many projects do you have going on right now?
I have a lot. I have a lot of little small projects. Yeah. I mean, I have over a dozen, but it's just what I have to do to, I feel like I don't have a home at the moment. I'm sort of floating around, and I help out, whatever chefs that need help. And Julian being a close friend is one of them. And there are other small projects that I have that goes on.
Yeah. And as far as consulting, it's mainly on the sweet side on pastry,
I do have a few
dessert.
That I do savory food as well. I have a Thai restaurant in Times Square called Chi.
Yeah.
That's something I do savory food for. I also do some savory food at Papa Lounge, San Francisco and New York. So, whatever the client wants. A lot of times people come to me for Asian food as well, in particular Thai and Chinese.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's start from the beginning. Where were you born? Where did you grow up? And this goes out to both of you.
I was born in Thailand. I left when I was 4. I lived in Singapore up until the point of high school, with Hong Kong and Japan in between, because I traveled around a lot with my mom when I was younger. It was kind of like a whirlwind, you know, with her. And I basically followed her wherever she goes. But in the end, I stayed through elementary school with my aunt in Singapore. And then after I finished, I came here to the States to come to college. Went to Brandeis and then went to California.
Yeah. I mean, but you went to Brandeis for something completely different than food.
Yeah, I majored in math and English.
Yeah. And then UCal Berkeley, too.
It was for architecture, yeah.
Yeah. And then when did that transition to cuisine, culinary arts happen?
Well, I've always cooked. I cooked at home when I was 7. I was like by 7, I already baked my first cookie.
Yeah.
By 12, I already made pies and, you know, made
what was your
pork
first
chops
cookie?
And chocolate chip.
Yeah. Everyone's first cookie is chocolate chip, right?
It's everybody likes that.
Yeah. So
we even have it at Coppelia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Is it
and La Esquina.
Is it
it's a different one, though, I promise.
I know you have to. You kind of have to separate yourself and stay true to each project. How do you do that when there are so many similar foundations?
I try to figure out what the chef likes, you know, and then I go from there. You know, I know Akhtar has, with his Indian background, he, you know, tried to do some kind of Indian inspired Mexican desserts.
Yeah, this is like the most mutted cuisine I've ever heard.
It's what?
Like Indian, Asian,
Mexican, oh no, it Latin. Works really yeah. well. You have to go yeah. see to believe it. Yeah, I yeah. mean, like, he takes monkfish and he puts in like a pistachio sauce, and he puts them in little what do you call that, canteen pinto things, and then he serves them Thali style. I think it's really fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, he's also from Kentucky as well, so he's a southern yes. Indian cooking yes. Mexican.
There's some of that too. Yeah,
yeah. Kind of fascinating. And Julian, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Mexico City.
Yeah, yeah. And was it always cooking in mind?
Well, it was in a point where after high school, when I started liking it, you know, seeing like my family, my grandfather used to cook a lot. Even my father cooks a lot now. You know, he loves to gather friends and you know, family every weekend, and he cooks, he barbecues, he does a lot of stuff. So it was just like I grew up with that every day. So I don't know. It just came up to me that I wanted to be a chef or so, and I started working in Mexico, back in Mexico.
Yeah.
For like a few years. And then I just decided to move out of Mexico. I think I felt like I needed to do something else with my life at that point.
Well, it's fascinating. In your bio, it was saying that you worked at Hotel Nico.
Yes.
Which, even though in Mexico City, the majority of the food was French.
It was in a French restaurant that it was Les Celebrites or something. That they had one here also in New York.
Yeah.
And it was just that. You know, very classic French cuisine. So that was basically my training.
Yeah.
Back there, when I came here, I didn't know much about Mexican food, actually.
Yeah.
I, of course, been Mexican stuff and working in with Richard Sandoval. Oh. That I worked with him even before he started doing his first Mexican project. He being Mexican, he wanted to do something.
Yeah, and what kind of projects did you work on? I mean, a lot of people know Richard Sandoval in New York, but I think the younger generation doesn't.
Yeah.
He had Savan.
Exactly, I worked at Savan. I actually came to work at Savan. For a friend to a friend, he's like, well, I know this guy, and you know, here's his number if you want to call him. So one day I just decided to pick up the phone and call him.
Yeah.
And ask him for a job. And he's like, well, you know, I don't have anything right now, but I will give you a call. So the next day he gave me a call at the hotel.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, come over. I have a job for you. I think, you know, we can work out something. So he's like, when can you be here? In 2 weeks?
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
So basically I was there, you know, after a month. But, you know, I left my job at the hotel, and then I moved here without knowing where I was going to stay or anything. He's like, don't worry, I'll give you, you know, don't worry, just go and ask for the manager at the Saban. And the guy was Mexican too, Ricardo, another Ricardo. And he's like, you're going to stay with him and stuff. So I didn't even, I mean, I was a little in the plane without knowing where I was going to stay that day.
That's a lot of faith in cooking. Right? A lot of faith in chefs, yeah.
So, and then I started in Saban with him, you know, working, and the one on the east side.
Yeah.
He had two at the time. And then, you know, he mentioned to me that he wanted to do a Mexican restaurant. But that happened within, like, after a year and a half or two.
Yeah.
A year and a half.
And that was Maya?
That was Maya, the first venture. So he's like, you know, he was actually looking for a chef to run that place because he didn't want to be a chef. And then he ended up being the chef.
Yeah.
Being, you know, a chef after CIA, that he went to CIA. And then he's like, well, you want to be like my sous chef, chef de cuisine? I say, sure.
Yeah.
So me being like 22 at the time, I was just like, okay, I'll take the responsibility. and from there it was, you know, I mean, he was there the first 6 months, and then you know, after we got a review from the Times, Ruud Rijssel gave us the 2 stars. So after that, he was just gone, yeah. And he started, you know, growing his empire.
Yeah, Sushi Samba being part of that.
And no, he's actually not at Sushi Samba. Okay. I was at Sushi Samba.
Oh, you were at Sushi Samba.
After that, I worked for him like as his corporate chef. Mm-hmm. For a few years and opening here and there, and then I moved to Sushi Samba after that.
Yeah, it's just fascinating how long it took you to get to the cuisine you grew up with. I mean, Pichet, did you?
Me too. I never thought I would do Thai food.
Yeah. How long in your career did it take to get to cooking Thai?
Oh, I guess 20 years.
Yeah.
This is the 20th anniversary of my cooking career, and I think it's the first time I'm doing Thai food, and now considering doing Chinese food.
Yeah. Yeah.
First time.
But how does it change in your mind after having cooked for 20 years? Well, how do you reapproach that food?
Well, to be honest, I still have more savory experience than pastry. I still have probably about 11 years of savory cooking. So I'm still more adept in savory cooking in a way. But I think Asian flavor lent itself really easily to for me, because my whole point of my most favorite part of food is, you know, sweet notes. That's my focus. Yeah. Sweet notes in food in general, caramelization of anything, bringing out the best of food through using sugar and sweetness of natural sweetness of ingredients, and so Thai food has a lot of that going on, and Chinese as well. So I think it's quite a natural process for me to transition.
Yeah, and then jumping ahead again to Kapalia. I mean, I've eaten at Yerba Buena a couple times, and I feel like a lot of you know, the acidity, the juices, a lot of the natural flavors that you have there also have those hints of natural sugar.
Yes, I think Julian's food food in general has a sweet note as well. It's very complex, you know, and I think one of the things that's misunderstood in cooking is people tend to focus so much on salt, but in a way, sweetness, not necessarily adding sugar, but just using fruit or using a sweeter vinegar or sweeter cuts of meat or fish. In very subtle ways, bring out the best in food.
Yeah,
I think.
And I mean, Julian, did you ever tap into your dessert chef self and try to do that alone before calling Pichet?
It was going to be a lot of work. I had already a lot of work just worrying about for just the regular menu, and I wanted to do something different. And I know that Pichet is that guy that is different, and you know, he has his work ethic it's very professional and stuff. Being us friends also, you know, I let him do whatever he needs to do because he's amazing in what he does.
Yeah.
And and Pichet has this thing where, you know, he sees ingredients where I'm using and stuff, and then he comes up with something like, you know, it's like comparable with you know, my food or just trying to make the right thing, you know, for the place. Like he does some chicharrones covered chocolate, which is brilliant, and stuff like that, you know. I mean, that he puts a lot of salt, he uses a lot of salt in his pastries that I think, you know, so to balance sometimes of the flavors, and as he says, bring the natural sugars of a lot of stuff, that's the way to go. And you know, my cooking is just, you know, doing after the yerba buena, it's just also that, you know, having the mixture of all Latin America, South America, and, you know, take my favorite dishes from there, and then from there I'll make them my own kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not reinventing the wheel or anything, but it's just, you know, it's just comfort food that is just, especially in Kapalia, you know, it's a very laid-back place where you can go and have, I don't know, whatever you want, a ceviche at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. I mean, in Mexico and most Latin America, when you grow up and then you go, you know, you stay late, you hang out with your friends, you go to a bar, you party and stuff. At 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock, you're hungry.
Yeah.
So in Mexico, we have, well, in every country, I guess, but in Mexico, we have the tacos al pastor and stuff that you go, you eat, you know. You know, we have things on the menu that you can get like the whole 24 hours like that. So
yeah, I mean, where did that culture disappear to? For a long time, I don't think there was a 24-hour joint for chefs to go to afterwards.
I think nightlife in New York has changed
since
when I first came here in the 80s. It's there's less of it.
Yeah,
I mean, aside from Koreatown,
yeah,
there are very few options to go out as late in the morning. So, you know, at Coppelia, we try to offer that, and it's something for everyone. You find your own craving there. You know, you may have a taco, or you can have like a chocolate chip cookie, or any kind of drinks that we have. We're getting our liquor license soon. Right now, we just have juices, but pretty soon we're going to have a whole line of cocktails and beer as well. So, yeah, like a diner, you can go just about for anything. You can have a salad, or you know, you can have like a whole plate of food or breakfast.
Yeah. So from Julian's background, what sweet notes of Latin cuisine have you pulled out for your own desserts?
Oh, I think you know, naturally there's a lot of tomato which is used, and very few people realize that it's actually a fruit. Right?
Yeah.
So there's you know, it's predominantly used, and you know, it's not like you add sugar to it, but you're adding a sweet note to your sauce. There's, you know, a mole that Julian does, a kind of mole that he does with chicken wings. That's really delicious. The alitas, right? You have chocolate in there. Right.
Yeah, and it has dried fruit, and I mean, it has a lot of, you know.
Yeah, that dish was actually coming up from like a spicy sour sauce, but we add chocolate just to balance it a little bit, you know.
And the bitterness also makes it very mouth-watering, because actually, you know, if you had a bitter soup or a bitter anything zest, your mouth starts to get watery, and then your taste bud is susceptible to tasting anything else that comes along with it. So I think that's pretty basic. You know, cooking trick or feeding trick that we do.
So you add bitter to create salivation create
flavors.
Yeah,
opening up your.
So are there other ways that you use flavor to block or enhance another?
Salt is another good one, especially coarse salt like Maldon salt, which he also uses. Because if the first thing you taste is salt, then you sort of, you know, you feel like this is going to go well, you know, somehow in your mind you it's tricked into saying, you know, this taste is going to go well, and you taste all the other stuff along with it.
Excellent. Have you pulled out some of, you know, Piché's Asian ingredients, BM Chinese, BM Thai, to then incorporate?
He stole my tamarind.
You shared tamarind.
Well, you know what is the good thing about it? It's just like we were talking about Indian and, you know, Mexican ingredients and, you know, Chinese and Thai. The food is kind of similar in a way, you know. The uses of spices and chilies and stuff is just, you know, it's just very similar, you know.
Lime juice.
Yeah, we use a lot of, citrus. Vinegar. I like to use a lot of citrus in my cooking, you know, because you want that pop, you know, and it's very similar. So we kind of use the same ingredients. I mean, tamarind in Mexican cooking is kind of a staple too, you know. So, but that comes from obviously from Asia, right?
Yeah.
We love tamarind. I mean, in Mexico, you literally go and, you know, you eat candy, a tamarind candy with, you know, salty and spicy and stuff like that. I mean, I grew up with that, you know, eating those kind of candies.
Yeah,
Right? Not like the sweet and, you know, candies that
they're
like.
I think the first time I ever had a tamarind candy, a salted tamarind candy.
Did you like that?
Not the first time. I mean, I've grown to understand it. Because I think without having that inherently in your childhood,
it's an acquired taste.
Yeah, yeah.
But it took me a long time to get used to apple pie.
Well, we're going to take a quick break right now and, you know, travel a little more around the world through Piché and Julian. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back. welcome back to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Piché Ong and Julian Medina. And we were just talking about, we ended right on apple pie, and Piché took him a while to actually enjoy that flavor, that experience.
I was kidding.
No, I mean, I know people that, you know, never had chocolate chip cookies up until, you know, their 20s, and they're still not 100% sure they like chocolate. I didn't have a sweet tooth up until I met my girlfriend, and wouldn't eat that. I'd crave more of the bitter than the sweet thing. So
yeah, I grew up with milk chocolate myself. I think every kid grows up with milk chocolate, you know. And pretty soon they discover bittersweet and other varieties of chocolate, but I still like milk chocolate.
Yeah. Which actually is a great segue into, Piché and I were chatting a little about how America's, well, New York more specifically, has been simplifying a lot of things. You don't go out for, you know, steak bordelaise, you go out for a hamburger, you don't go out for...
Nice restaurants,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. It's but it's not a downgrade, it's just literally a simplification of cuisine. You know, pizza and burgers are in most restaurants, but you've seen that a lot with desserts as well, so... Leaping from milk chocolate, the candy bar, you don't see Jocans, you don't see Genoise cakes, you don't see more complex features of pastry chef skills. You see deconstructed, you know, candy bars, Snickers, etc.
Well, people like familiarity these days. So even if you're doing something complicated like a baked Alaska, it's still something that people identify with. Lemon meringue pie, yeah. S'more, and they're not necessarily easy to make. I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's familiar to people, yeah. And people tend to go for that. You know, it's along the same line as a restaurant. Regardless of cuisine, you could be a steakhouse, you could be Italian, you could be Korean. And you sort of have a burger on the menu, which is very strange for me, or pizza.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's something familiar about those categories of food that New Yorkers go for. And this is regardless of price, because you have burgers that are like $38, and it's not necessarily cheap either.
Yeah.
But you know, what I grew up with is like 99 cents burger, you know.
It's kind of fascinating, though, that you do see burger across every level. I mean, Copalia, I'm assuming, has a burger on the menu.
Yeah, we have a few burgers.
Yeah. Is this your first burger on a menu?
Yeah, I think so. And Toluach, I have a burger also for lunch.
Yeah.
That I made it like Mexican with poblanos and chiles and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is different. And people like, it's not the best seller. Obviously, they go for the tacos or quesadillas. But also, as Piché says, it's just that, you know, the comfort... Comfort food is just comfort food for everybody. It doesn't matter, you know, where you go or whatever. You know, you can have a burger on the menu and it's not going to, you know, downgrade you or something. Yeah. It's just like, you know, I think it's more for the comfort part. And I think, cooking of like every chef in New York has just been, you know, going towards that. So I think, and I agree, because I like comfort food. Mm-hmm. You know, you feel more like in home. Or stuff, you know, the things that you grow up, I mean.
Yeah, but it's funny to note that the more successful comfort food restaurants have chefs that have spent years and years in the kitchen. I mean, combined, you guys have how many? Almost 40 years of kitchen experience? And only now are you starting to turn back to, you know, comfort food or simplification.
I have to be honest. I mean, I love comfort food too, but yeah. I do miss the days of like friends flying into New York and going for like Les Pinas or Les Celebrités or, you know, these, or, you know, restaurants that don't have burgers on menus, you know. And now when, as soon as chefs come to New York, they're like, okay, let's go get a burger. Let's go get a pizza. I'm like, are you sure?
Yeah.
You know, it's just a bit strange, a phenomenon for me.
Yeah.
You know, you would think that you know, culinary palates have advanced. I mean, maybe they have advanced for burger, but it's, you know, we're going back to basics in a way.
Yeah. So, I mean, what dishes of haute cuisine do you guys hope to reintroduce back to New York?
Haute cuisine?
Yeah.
What dishes?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, there's like so many. I like the fact that there's crudo appearing everywhere now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another thing that's actually very simple in general. Like crudo, it just relies so much on freshness of ingredient. You know, at Coppelle we have a ceviche, which is, you know, kind of like a crudo. And I think, you know, with appearance of that in all types of menu, particularly with Italian restaurants, I think it's a really good thing.
So crudo is kind of like what burger has been. It's appearing in Italian. It's appearing in Latin American.
You should see more of that in any kind of cuisine.
Yeah.
I mean, we see it in I think every type of cuisine in the world has a kind of raw product, you know, on the menu. I love the Korean beef tartare.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, once again, you said at least there's K-Town still.
Right.
That can, you know, feed us that. What's interesting to note, too, is, you know, from your diverse backgrounds, there's even more heritage and ethnicity introduced. And I'm looking at you, Julian, when you converted to Judaism.
Yep.
And your wife is Jewish.
Yep.
New York Jew, too, right?
Yep.
Born and raised. And
yes.
When you converted, you also started incorporating a lot of those flavors and traditions into your food. And I mean, you cook a Hanukkah meal every year, maybe even a Seder, Passover.
Well, being, of course, learning more about the culture and stuff, you also grow learning, you know, the holidays and stuff and eating, you know, it's everybody, you know, eats, you know, they have the specific things to eat in, you know, certain holidays. So I thought once, why not make it, you know, in Mexico, we have a big Jewish population, Mexico City. So we have like a couple of temples there, and you know, they also incorporate, you know, a lot of the Jewish traditions with the Mexican, you know, flair. So because they, you know, they grew up there in Mexico, so they have a lot of like similarities, you know. So it occurred to me to do a Mexican Hanukkah for the first time back in Zocalo and being in the Upper East Side, and it was great success, you know.
Yeah.
Like things on the menu, like the first time that I did this brisket taco, you know, it was like, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, and then it was so popular that I just keep it on the menus.
Yeah.
So it's an everyday, you know, taco, because it was great. It was just like great thing. So.
Yeah, and we actually had done an article about that specific meal that you made for Edible Brooklyn. I remember there was an apple tomatilla salsa, I think. And yeah. I'm like, that's one of the best choroses I've ever seen.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like that. I mean, we do, you know, the latke trio. So the potato with the jalapeno, the zucchini with the apple.
Yeah.
Tomatillo dipping sauce, and I make a cheese, actually a Mexican cheese, you know, latke too.
Yeah.
So it's just like a little bit of a blend. I mean, when I go visit back to Mexico City, I actually buy a few books of, you know, Jewish cuisine in the made from Mexicans or whatever, and you know, it's very interesting how the mixture of cultures just combine, you know, they work very well using Mexican ingredients.
Yeah.
You know? So it's a very nice way just to, you know, just to come and do your holiday in a different way kind of thing. So, and people love it, you know, one of the weeks that is very slow for the rest of the restaurant business being the Jewish holidays, you know, we're actually good because, you know, all these people that they wanted to do it the second or the third night that they're already bored from the mama's brisket, you know, they come to a restaurant just to have something different, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, the matzah ball soup, I also have my touches there, you know, I put some zucchini flowers, more like a Mexican chicken broth, some jalapeno, some lime, some raw onion, some. It's a I make it traditional, but I put my own ingredients, you know, Mexican touches.
Yeah. I mean, Pichet, you've been around the world, Beijing, Istanbul, Sydney, consulting these areas. Are there any cuisines or ingredients that you didn't expect to come into your lexicon that, you know, I'm sure you didn't initially expect Judaism to be a big part of your cooking life at first. But, I mean, have you seen things around the world that you didn't expect to now be part of your repertoire?
Well, it's still... It's actually still a learning curve for me when I travel. I always see something new. I mean, I've seen a lot, but every time I go to a different place, I always see something new. I think New York is a melting pot, but when you actually go to places like Singapore or Sydney, it's even more of a melting pot. And in a way, it's a lot more natural over there just because it's been going on. Fusion food has been going on a lot longer. When you actually open a restaurant in Sydney, I feel like it's just, you do have to do fusion There's no other way of escaping it. You know, it's just a more natural process of it over there. And even when you go to Singapore or Hong Kong, you go to an Italian restaurant or a French restaurant, there's bound to be Asian flavors in there just because that's what the population desires, you know?
Yeah. It's, you know, with all these kind of compounded words, I mean, beginning maybe in the U.S. with Tex-Mex, I mean, now you have like, what, Jumex? I don't know what to necessarily call it. I think fusion is kind of a cop-out word because it just means, oh, I've just taken all these things and put them together. But it's a fascinating thing that I don't hear the word fusion that much anymore.
Right, I know.
Because it's all just mudded together.
It's just a matter of word. I think right now that category would be like, what, eclectic or international or modern, contemporary. I mean, it's just a matter of words. Yeah. It's just change, but it's still the same. It's still sort of fusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the movement of Jewish-based foods or kosher food is actually on the rise.
Yeah.
It's really quite amazing. So, I actually started out as a kosher chef at Brandeis. I was a chef at the kosher cafeteria.
Yeah. Well, then that leads me to my last question. When are you guys going to open up a Jewish deli/donut shop? I mean, Sufyanot's would be excellent in this city.
That wouldn't be a bad idea, actually.
Yeah.
And it's something you can also take to Mexico City.
Yeah, yeah. You never know. We might see another mashup cuisine restaurant come out of YouTube yet. Also, we're going to have to hopefully have another episode with YouTube because we have so much more to talk about. But we, unfortunately, are running out of time. But I wanted to thank you, Piché, Julian. If you haven't checked out Kupalia, any hour of the day, stop by from anything from a burger to a ceviche and a chocolate chip cookie. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Hope to have you here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The Heritage Meat Shop has just opened in the Essex Street Market. Open from 9 to 7 Monday through Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sundays, the Heritage Meat Shop supports independent family farms and animal welfare approved and certified humane raising standards. Most importantly, they offer a wide variety of heritage breeds. So stop by, get a sandwich, try the charcuterie, the Heritage Meat Shop at the Essex Street Market. This is a message from Fork and Anger. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anger, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today.